Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Karen Conti here. We've got 2 hours of talk about some interesting topics. We are going to be talking about the case of the woman who was murdered and had her baby cut from her. And we're going to talk about it a little bit from a psychological standpoint. What kind of woman would do this? What kind of people commit these types of crimes? We have a doctor coming on who actually has written about this topic and is very knowledgeable about the psychology behind it. It's fascinating sometimes why people do these horrible, horrible things. But interestingly, they kind of do the same thing in the same ways. And the patterns are things that the doctors like to study. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And as I said on Crosstalk with Brian Noonan, we're going to be talking about the healthcare system in this country with a phenomenal expert who goes all over the world to talk about healthcare systems and how things can be changed for the better. He was the CEO of the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, and he has some great knowledge about how you can benefit from navigating the hospital system and what we might expect in the future. And I know that Jerry, my husband, is sitting here, and he has he's been bugging me to talk about this issue. We've been talking about this issue all weekend.
Were you talking about the baby being cut from the mother?
No. The Monsanto case.
Oh, the Monsanto case. Sorry. You woke me up.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I did wake you up.
You know, it's big tobacco all over again.
Well, and for people to know this, and I don't know if it was as huge news in the legal community, was huge news. It was a $2 billion verdict against Monsanto, who makes Roundup, the weed killer, right? And, you know, it was $2 billion. I mean, that's an epic verdict. You know, what is the average? I mean, from a lawyer's standpoint, I have a lot to say about that. But from the layman's standpoint, what is the thought?
Well, my thought is simply this. As I said, it's the tobacco industry all over again. $2 billion is phenomenal. First of all, people have to be careful with all chemicals. But I think the problem was they knew it and they hid it. But there's going to be appeal after appeal. This is going to go on for 10 years. And I promise you this is going to come down to $200 million, not $2 billion. And I think they should be punished with $2 billion. But unfortunately, that's the way the system works.
I think this is an interesting time to have a case like this. This is not the first case that has been tried against the Roundup people. This is the third, and there have been 3 jury verdicts in favor of the plaintiff. And remember, this verdict was only in favor of one family. It wasn't like a group of people. So there are 13,000 pending cases with farmers and other people who have used the products over the years, whether commercial grade or otherwise. So this is sort of a test case, and my guess is that Monsanto is going to take its insurance money, take whatever other money they have, and basically settle these cases in some sort of consumer class action fashion rather than keep trying them, because this really, I mean, as much money as Monsanto is worth, it could put them out of business. But, you know, I wonder, you know, a lot of people are writing about, do juries really get it? Are these juries being reactive to sympathy? And are they ignoring science? And are they not following what the scientific principles say? I mean, is there causation between cancer and this product? My guess is that the judge would not let this go to trial unless there was significant evidence that there could be a causation and a proof of the causation. But you know what? I trust jurors. I do. I trust jurors, and I trust jurors more than I would trust a single sitting judge, because in my 33 years of experience, it seems to me that 12 people in the community who don't know each other, come from different walks of life, can get together and make very intelligent, very well-reasoned decisions. And the decisions that you see that aren't well-reasoned, that you disagree with, might have something to do with something you didn't see at trial, or they could make a mistake, and there's no question that jurors make mistakes. But again, I think that jurors should decide these important cases, and that it's up to the attorneys to present evidence that's complicated. You know, I mean, it's complicated evidence. How does Roundup apparently cause cancer? Is there some, you know, can someone explain that to a person who doesn't have any medical experience? My guess is that the lawyers did a really good job of having their experts do that, and that resulted in the verdict. But you're probably right. This is like tobacco, and it's going to be handled in a way that is going to be done with a group and a class action. Probably.
You know, and everything, well, you know how cynical and skeptical. I'm so skeptical, I don't even believe myself. But, you know, welcome to capitalism. These companies are willing to do anything they need to do to bolster that bottom line there. They have to pay attention to their stockholders. And it's a sad commentary on our society. But as my friend in California, Richard, always says, it's capitalism. You're free to starve to death.
I think that the idea of, the legal system being the vehicle to tell people that certain things are unsafe. I mean, you know, asbestos was known to cause problems, and they used it anyway. And the legal system brought that to the attention, you know, same with Ralph Nader and some of the things that he's done. And whether you think lawyers should put money in their pocket is one thing, but think of how safe our society is compared to other societies who don't have lawyers out there, you know, waving the flag. But that's just me being a lawyer. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to be talking about this horrible case of the woman who was murdered and the psychology behind it. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Clarissa Figueroa, 46, and her daughter Desiree, 24, lured 19-year-old Marlon Ochoa Lopez to their home on the pretext they had free baby clothes to give her. They strangled her to death and removed the baby from her body and threw her body in a trash bin. Mother and daughter have been charged with first-degree murder, daughter's boyfriend charged with concealing a murder. All three are now being held without bond. The baby is in grave condition. Here to discuss the psychology in these kinds of bizarre and horrific crimes is Dr. N.G. Barrell. For 3 decades, he's been a clinical and forensic psychologist who provides consultation to New York State federal courts and state courts on criminal and family matters. He's the executive director of the New York Center for Neuropsychological and Forensic Behavioral Science. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me. This isn't the first time this type of thing has happened. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say, definitely.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the psychology of what happens when a woman does this kind of thing?
Well, typically, it's a woman working alone. I mean, the case you just cited is unique in that there's co-conspirators. But let's start with the notion that someone's doing this by themselves. Quite often, women who have been implicated in these kinds of acts have a sort of delusional idea that they must have a child. Now, that may be driven by the fact that they lost a child. That may be driven by the fact that they've always wanted to have a child and couldn't. But it reaches such extreme proportions, at least in their mind, that they're willing to, for instance, go to hospitals. And you know, there are a lot of cases from years ago where they, you know, lift infants from the nursery and raise these children as their own. I mean, is that important to them? It's sort of like a maternal instinct run amok. But the case you were just citing is unique to my way of thinking.
Well, one of the things that we have learned is that the mother here who perpetrated the crime, who is the ringleader here, had a 20-year-old son who recently died due to natural causes. And in the last moments of the life of this poor 19-year-old girl who had the misfortune of going to her house, she had actually shown this poor girl a picture of her son and was talking to her about the fact that she had lost her son. So this kind of fits into what you're saying, that there was a loss or there's a need, in at least in her mind, to replace that child.
I guess to some degree. I think that what's fascinating, though, is that she got some people to act along with her, because clearly, you know, she committed a murder. Typically, we're talking about kidnapping, but this is beyond the pale. This is actually seducing someone to come to the house, or, you know, tricking them under false pretenses, and willing to actually commit a murder with several people assisting. So it's quite bizarre when you have two or three people acting in concert for the sole purpose, presumably, of stealing this baby. It's very unusual.
You know, I was just Googling around, and there is a website called Fake a Baby www.tobacco.com, where you can actually go on and get fake ultrasounds to show people, and they have fake bellies that you can affix to your, you know, your body to make it look like you're pregnant, and a whole host of other things. And, you know, I guess I just don't know what to make of that. But is there some idea that women, some women feel like being pregnant is such a, like a attention getter, that it's sort of like a Munchausen by proxy, like when you're pregnant, you get treated differently, you get put on a pedestal, and you reap some benefit by virtue of being pregnant? Is that part of some of these crimes?
Well, I mean, you do. I mean, most people, strangers, will speak to pregnant women, ask to touch their belly or congratulate them. I mean, there's no question that a pregnant woman, under normal circumstances, is going to receive typically positive feedback from complete strangers, you know, the supermarket or the store, etc. The fact that someone is craving that kind of attention, or that they have such deficits in their life that they're willing to pretend to be pregnant, or willing to, you know, use these artificial devices or what have you, in order to garner the attention they're looking for, is more than pathetic. It speaks to a level of despair, I think, and character pathology. I don't think they're necessarily delusional. I think they're well aware of the fact that they're feigning a pregnancy, but they want all that comes with it. And perhaps they truly want to be pregnant and can't be, or that may be part of the picture. So they get some of the satisfaction of the attention and the well wishers stopping them, etc. But It is sad.
And we had a case here similar about 25 years ago. The perpetrators, I think there were three of them, and all are still in jail. And it was Deborah Evans was her name, I recall. They went and they took the baby from her, killed her, took the baby. The baby lived, but I think part of the whole process of that was, the woman who wanted the baby wanted to cement her relationship, if I'm not mistaken, with a gentleman. And the idea was that she was going to fake this pregnancy or have this baby, and then that relationship was going to be solid because they had a baby together. So right. There was another element to the whole process.
Right. Well, yeah. You're using the child to, as you say, cement or manipulate this fellow, you know, in terms of bonding. So, and in a sense, that's a cliche anyway, isn't it? Maybe a little less so now, but I remember, people getting pregnant, women getting pregnant, you know, in order to solidify relationships, perhaps on purpose. I mean, that used to be said sometimes about pregnancies, but the notion that you would kill someone and steal their baby, it goes way beyond that kind of idea, you know, or that kind of manipulation. I mean, the willingness to commit murder and then kidnap someone's child, all to cement a relationship, lets you know how deeply disturbed.
Dr. Beryl, just we have about 30 seconds, but I just want to ask you the question. I have to ask the question. I know you consult with the courts on some of these kinds of cases. This woman is not criminally insane under the laws of our country, correct? She's not. She knows that what she's doing is wrong. She appreciates.
Correct. Yeah, no.
So she's not.
Right.
So she's, you know, she could conceivably lodge an insanity defense, but it probably wouldn't be successful. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, you know, anyone can lodge an insanity defense for anything, but you know, if she had. If they can demonstrate, which it sounds like they could fairly easily, the intent, you know, to commit this crime for whatever reason there is, you know, you would have to really demonstrate that you were delusional. You were thinking about this thing from such a bizarre perspective that doesn't even begin to satisfy anybody's normal way of thinking about these things. So these kind of cases.
Almost psychotic, you know. She just
She would have to be completely psychotic and believe that she was sparing the child, you know, from Satan or something, you know, something
right.
That would be absolutely beyond belief. But if she believed it, that might be an insanity offense. But
right.
If there's a purpose, you know, You need the child. You want the child. You want to replace a lost child. You want to fulfill some deep need to apply maternal instinct. You know, you're lonely. You feel incomplete. These kinds of things aren't going to meet the standard for
them. No, they certainly aren't. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Dr. N.G. Barrell. He's the executive director of New York Center for Neuropsychology and Forensic Behavioral Science. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN.
I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ill. I got a
The U.S. healthcare system has been criticized and politicized for years. I think we've all experienced some frustration in the area of healthcare, from cost of insurance, lengthy waits for procedures, to insurance companies not covering treatments, cost-prohibitive medicine. While tonight's guest maybe doesn't have all the solutions, he's got some great views and suggestions on how change can happen and how it might happen in the future. Steve Bonner has been actively involved in the business of healthcare for 25 years. He was a CEO of Cancer Treatment Centers of America for 15 years and has been on the board for 20 years. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in healthcare by Modern Healthcare magazine. He's taught MBA students and served as an entrepreneur in residence at the Harvard Business School, and he's currently an advisor to four private equity firms, also advisor to EIT Health, a healthcare innovation organization created and funded by the European Union. Welcome to the show, Steve. I'm glad to have you on.
Thank you, Karen. It's great to be with you.
It's one of the topics that I hear so much about, with frustration with listeners who have problems with health coverage and navigating the system. You're very aware of how we stand in relation to other countries. Are there other countries who are doing healthcare better, and how and what countries?
Sure, I think so. And first, I just would point out that the challenge we face in America is a challenge that's shared by every country in the world, because people are living longer, they're living less healthy lives, so they have cardiac problems and diabetes and so forth. So the demand for health care is increasing faster than we're able to keep up with it. And I think a couple of the best countries that I've had a chance to see are probably Singapore and Switzerland. And they'll be hard to emulate, but there's a lot to learn from them.
And what are some of the things that you see in the healthcare systems that are working? And again, the political systems are very different, and their whole societies are very different than ours. So maybe what works there might not work here. But what are some of the things that you see that you like?
Right. For sure, the things that work well are that, to me, they're always a very nimble, integrated partnership among the government, private providers, and the consumers. And they work to be clear about what a patient's options are over the lifetime, and then to help them create sources of funds and control sources of funds that they can use to navigate their own health care. And then the providers in Singapore and in Switzerland, for example, work very hard to provide what the consumers want. And the consumers there play a significant role in navigating health care, deciding what they want. They might want the very most expensive care. They might want less expensive care, and they have that choice in both of those countries. They also work hard basically to pay as you go, either the government's share, an employer's share, or the consumer's share. So they're not building these huge unfunded future liabilities, which is one part of the big problem that we've got facing us in the U.S.
Briefly, we had a conversation before this about the history of healthcare in our country and how we sort of got away from consumers making the decisions that maybe they should be making. And that is the fact that employers generally are the big providers of healthcare for citizens in this country.
Right.
And exactly. How has that happened? How has that evolved? And how has that changed the way we as consumers are permitted to make decisions about health care?
Prior to World War II, health care was very much like every other consumer-oriented industry in the U.S. And you navigated the care that you wanted. You may have insurance or you may not have insurance. But during World War II, with all the labor force being off in war, the employers were looking for a way to compete with each other. And there were wage price freezes. They couldn't just spiral wages up. So they came up with the idea of offering family health care as a way to get workers. And we've now evolved to where The employer has been very dominant in designing health care and deciding what health care each family is going to get, then to wiring it into some network. So they have to go there for their care and also paying for their care. And so the consumer has had very little reason and very little opportunity to play the role that they play in every other industry in this country.
And do you think, in your opinion, from what you know and see, are consumers able to navigate this? Are they able to buy insurance? Are they able to make decisions? It's a complicated system. Are they able to do it? And should they be doing it?
Yes, and that's part of the great excitement for me and what's going on in healthcare. And we may talk about Obamacare in a couple of minutes.
I would like to talk about that.
But one of the best things that I think Obamacare did was that it reengaged the consumer into their healthcare, because without intending it, Obamacare started to increase co-pays and deductibles. So all of a sudden, the consumer is required to pay up front for the initial costs of their care. And as consumers in America, we're used to doing that. We're not used to doing it in healthcare. But when we do that, all of a sudden we say, wait a minute, now I want to understand what this is. What are you recommending to me?
What am I paying for?
What am I paying for?
Right,
exactly. And the system is not taken the responsibility to provide that kind of information to consumers before a decision is made. But we now have all of us, regardless of where we are in the age spectrum, we're much more nimble at getting information, analyzing our information, making our decisions, implementing it, and being accountable for it. And so you've got all these, especially early consumers, younger consumers,
yeah,
coming into healthcare and saying, wait a minute, where's my information? And if you can't even give me the basic information, quality, cost, motivation, outcomes, you don't get my business. I'll go somewhere else.
So the millennials are going to be teaching us something, perhaps.
Oh, they are. Because
they do. They love their information. Whether they're buying a car or going out to dinner, they seem to know all of the facts by getting onto their little phone and finding out what they need to know.
Right. But even us near centennials are navigating information and making,
sure,
decisions very differently than we were 10 or 15 years ago.
Let's talk about Obamacare. I heard you describe yourself as a fiscal conservative and a social moderate. So that said, because I don't want to get politicize this, do you believe that how is the politicization of healthcare adversely impacted healthcare in the United States? Because we all know Obamacare is bad, according to some Republicans. Obamacare is the greatest thing in the world, according to some Democrats. And I don't think most people even know what it does.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yes, it's totally politicized. And if you try to have a healthcare conversation in a political environment, one side goes one way, the other side goes the other way, and you're left with nothing. And that's basically where we've gotten to with healthcare, at least at the moment. Now, Obamacare, in my opinion, like almost everything else that the legislature does, is neither good or bad. It's a blend of both. And there are some very good things about Obamacare.
Well, so let's tell, what are some of the things that you think are good and some of the things that might need to be worked on?
So the very best thing about Obamacare, I think, is that as a country, we looked in the mirror and we said, somehow we're going to find a way to provide every American with access to quality health care at a reasonable price. And I just think that's so American, and it was long overdue for us to say that. And however we got it done politically, that's at the core of Obamacare. And that's worthy of preserving. It isn't perfect. I think that in addition to that, we tackled the pre-existing condition exclusion, which is insurance company fiction, in my opinion. We all have pre-existing conditions, just a question of, you know, what are they willing to put inside the circle and outside the circle. So we've done away with that, and I think that's great. You can underwrite it. It's fine. It's done. The insurance industry still survives several,
yep,
years later. You know, we're fine with that. I've also talked about the fact that it's re-engaged the consumer into the front end of healthcare and has asked them or told them or required them to pay for some things up front, and as a result to behave like consumers and teach this industry what they're expected to provide.
Let's talk, when we come back, a little bit about innovations that you have seen in the whole process. I know you're working on some things with your investors, and I want to talk about those. And then I want to end up talking a little bit about some practical advice for our listeners about how to navigate the system. I'm here with Steve Bonner, and this is the WGN Karen Conti Show. With Steve Bonner, we're talking about healthcare. He was the CEO of Cancer Treatment Centers of America for 15 years. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in healthcare by Modern Healthcare Magazine. Steve, we got a couple texts, and I'm going to kind of break them down as fast as I can here. They want to know, does the expert think it's a good step to get ahead of conditions as opposed to treating conditions when they first manifest themselves? And I take it that is in the context of insurance, or, you know, so that there should be an encouragement of treating general health as opposed to treating the disease once there's onset.
Yeah, well, I think that...
Oops, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, here I am.
Here you are. You lost your voice for a minute. No, I lost your voice. Right. Go ahead.
I think that underlying the whole challenge that we have in healthcare is that as individuals, we have to find ways to live healthier lives and stay healthy longer rather than waiting to deal with healthcare once we're sick. And so anything that we can do within the healthcare system to change our behaviors, encourage us, incent us, reward us for making sure that we stay healthy as long as we can, when we have a problem, find it as quickly as we can and solve it before it gets before it becomes extreme.
There was just an article in the paper this week. United Healthcare was blasted by a judge. I'm not going to go into the details, but apparently United Healthcare was denying certain types of cancer treatment to certain people. And the judge's comments were widely shared among patients and doctors who kind of felt that this large insurance company was wrongfully denying coverage to people who really needed it for things that were not experimental, although they, I believe, claimed they were experimental. What do you see as the solution to that? I mean, that's a big problem where I hear this all the time. My listeners will send me emails that heartfelt. I need to get this and I can't get it because I can't afford it and I can't sue my insurance company. How is this resolved?
It's a multifaceted solution, but the beginning of it is that the insurance companies and the government have to think differently about approving new therapies. And we've lived for a long time on basically requiring that any new therapy go through a 10-year study in order to be able to get approval and go into the market. And in the meantime, people are dying,
right,
who would benefit from that when it's ultimately approved. And a lot of that is based on assumptions in the way our bodies work that now are disrupted, and we can be a lot smarter about now that we can map the genome. And we should be able to look at these things together with artificial intelligence and big data at a genetic cellular level and make much quicker decisions.
You have an example of that that we talked about. Can you give our listeners just a little bit of an example on how you figure out what kind of cancer is responsive to certain types of treatment?
Sure. I'm one company that I'm on the board of and an investor in. Is dealing with this very issue, which is if you and I both get pancreatic cancer, any treatment center we go to in the world is going to say we both have pancreatic cancer, so we should get the same treatment. And it'll work for one of us and it won't work for the other. Why is that? And it's because we're finding that even though we have a primary tumor in the same location, yours actually looks like a melanoma. It's not really a pancreatic cancer. And so we can look at that. And how can we assess all the drugs that are available and make sure you get the right drug? And we love to try to get enough tumor from a patient than to be able to test it against a variety of different drugs rather than just the one that's been approved by a 10-year study. The problem is getting enough of that tumor. And so the company that I'm working with has developed a specially bred immune-suppressed nude mouse. And they get as much tumor material as they can from a patient, and then they microsurgically implant it in exactly the same location in the mouse. And because the mouse has no immune system, the cells that it grows from that tumor are patient cells. They're not mouse cells. And we're getting 70% metastasis, rapid growth of these cells. And then we have enough so we can take a panel of drugs, go into the lab, and test these cells against a drug and select from that the drug that looks like the best match and is most effective against the tumor of the individual patient.
Well, and that sounds like fabulous technology. I mean, and like you said, you're narrowing down what is this cancer. You can call it, because it's in the pancreas, you can call it pancreatic cancer, but it might have a whole different development and a whole different set of treatments that might be effective.
Right. It's a very different character than the broad brush we've given by just saying, where did the tumor first appear?
Let's talk a little bit about some other innovations. There was one that I really liked was the idea of you go into a hospital and they want you to get an MRI or they want you to get some sort of treatment and you have to wait to go to their clinic somewhere in the suburbs. Tell us what the innovations you're working on.
Yeah, so the one that, I mean, the innovations in healthcare, and this is where the great excitement is. You've got the politicization of the conversation, so Congress isn't going to solve it. You've got the big oligopolies trying to defend their old ways, like you talk about United Healthcare refusing to approve new stuff. But in the meantime, the innovation that's going on at the grassroots level in healthcare right now is just incredible. And we can talk about innovation in distribution, how we get it to patients, technology, devices, drugs, legal regulatory reimbursement, et cetera. And the example that you're talking about relates to a company here in Chicago called Health Engine. And you go to your healthcare provider. They say you need an MRI. We have one for you 2 weeks from Thursday. Be there at 2 o'clock, and we're going to charge you $4,000 for your MRI, and your copay will be $4,500. You go home and you go on the Health Engine website and you say, I live in this zip code. I need an MRI. I'm willing to travel 20 miles. What have you got for me? And they can go into their database and find that there's a open MRI machine at a MRI specialty clinic a mile from your home. It's open this afternoon at 3 o'clock. If you'll take it, they'll do your MRI for you for $3,000 and your copay will be $300. And if you do that, you get your MRI results 2 weeks earlier, your worrying is reduced because you're going to worry for
right.
2 weeks.
That's the big thing, right?
Well, that's a big thing. And then you saved this money. And then if you go back to Health Engine and say, I've done that, they will go to your insurance company and say, Karen just saved you $1,000. Cut her a check for half of it.
Wow.
Let's change the way this whole market works and start connecting, you know, cost with value, with quality, with outcomes, with whatever it is the consumer wants.
It makes total sense, does it not?
It does. It's so rational.
And everybody's happy, and everybody's you know, it's an easy one for me. Let's talk a little bit about for people who are navigating the healthcare system out there, and we have a lot of listeners who have health issues, and they're getting older, and they're navigating the system by themselves or with a loved one. What are some of the tips you can give them?
Well, I think the most important tip is to step out of all the old behaviors where you're led to believe that the only option you have is to do what you're told in a network in order to get your insurance to pay for it. And this is your life, it's your body, and it's your decision, and you should be in control of that. And yes, there can be a very heavy lifting on your part to get all the information, but you're also legitimate in looking eyeball to eyeball with a caregiver and asking why. Why? Why? And what's going to happen? And what's the impact on me? And what are my options? What other options do I have? And I think working with our networks, our families, there's also a lot of conversation going on online with people that are dealing with the same kinds of issues. And you can find places where you can get yourself educated by somebody that doesn't have an interest in selling you something.
And one last question, and we have just a few minutes, just not even a minute. Crystal ball here. We're going to see a lot of changes coming up in the next 50 years. What are some of the changes? Can you bullet point for our listeners?
So I think that the themes that we've talked about are really going to flower. They're going to blossom. And the need for dramatic change in healthcare in the U.S. is undeniable. We're spending way too much money. People are too frustrated. The information is there. And so we're going to see much greater consumer control. We're going to see all of us as providers having to provide better information. We're going to use artificial intelligence, machine learning to get a lot smarter. The government, I think the FDA is already working harder to try to be more creative. The insurance companies are tough to bring along, but they're either going to be in the market or out of the market, and we're going to decide what that market is. I think that in addition, the huge opportunities that we have to understand how we manage our lives and to manage our lives more intelligently, from wearables to fitness centers, in employer situations or outside of employer situations, family support on these things, all of this, I think, is going to help us find ways to live healthier lives. And then when we have to navigate healthcare, to do it much more efficiently than we've been able to recently.
So we have something to look forward to in the healthcare field.
A lot to look forward to. It's our lives, right?
That's right. The most important thing. And we all know that. Steve Bonner, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you come back again and talk some more about some of the innovations that you're working on.
Love to.
This is the time you can call me and I can tell you what I think about your legal issue. If you have a legal question about anything, I will do my best to try to give you an answer or steer you in the right direction. If it's a family law matter, an employment matter, maybe it's a traffic ticket issue, a breach of contract, or a neighbor dispute, anything that is on your mind, or if it's something that you read in the news this week and you have a question about it, or you would like me to try to explain something, I am happy to try to do that. My number here is 312-981-7200, 981-7200, and you can text me to that same number, too, if you could just give me some facts. Ben is my producer. You'll talk to him. You'll quickly tell him what your issues are, and I may have some questions for you, and hopefully I can steer you in the right direction. 981-7200. And what I like to do also is to give out my office number, because some people don't feel comfortable talking on the radio, or maybe you want to go into some more detail, and that's a great way to get some advice, or maybe have me steer you in the right direction there too. And that my number is 312-332-7800, 332-7800. And you can always email me, which is probably the best way to reach me, because then I can get back to you, hopefully, with an answer or a referral or a link or somewhere to try to steer in the right direction. And that email address, and write it down, wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's ask Karen, K-A-R-E-N, Conti, C-O-N-T-I.com. wgn@askkarenconti.com. I see some calls are coming in, and Ben is furiously typing and trying to get somebody on the line. Do you want me to take Bruce? Okay. All right. Hi, Bruce from Lombard. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Hello. Hello, Bruce? Okay. Let's see. The phone is on. No, I'm not hearing him. Ben, any ideas about how to get him on? All right, here we go. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I was getting the silent treatment from you. No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. It's okay. So, Bruce, tell me what your legal issue is.
My wife is taking care of her 86-year-old father.
Okay.
She owns the house with him downtown as Fairbury. And I'm concerned about that if when he passes, does the house go directly to her, or do we own something to his estate?
Okay, so then I can't give you real specific advice here, because I'd have to look at the deed. But are you telling me that your wife is on the deed, so that the title of the home is in her name and her father's name?
Yes.
Okay, so if in the event that her father passes away, she would be entitled to that property. It wouldn't pass through the estate, it wouldn't pass through any trust or will. She would have ownership of it, and you would owe nothing to the estate. Now, of course, once you own the property, you know, you have to upkeep it, and you have to pay the taxes, and you have to use your own money to do that. Does her father have an estate plan, like a will and a trust and all that?
Yes.
Okay. And go ahead.
He's basically wrote her and her sister out of the will. Everything goes to a charity up in Wisconsin.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But the house is not part of that estate plan, and instead it's titled in her name as well.
Right. She co-signed with him to get it.
Yeah. And okay. So is she also on the mortgage?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
Okay, so then she's going to have that obligation as well. You know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to spend maybe an hour with an estate planning lawyer just to make sure that that this is in the papers are in working order. Not
right.
that you're going to change her father's will or trust because
right.
that you might be deemed to be, you know, unduly influencing. That's the words we use in the law, meaning
right.
that you're trying to get him to change something because you don't want to do that. But at least reading what you have to make sure that you know what your obligations
yeah.
are and you know what you're entitled to when he passes, so that when he does pass, you're making sure that you're making the payments and you're doing it correctly. And if you need a
right.
referral to somebody like that, call
yeah.
me at the office and I can send you to somebody who can give you some quick advice on that. Okay?
Okay.
All right, Bruce.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
All right.
Let's go to Darren in Mundelein. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
The situation that I have is last night, my sister-in-law was babysitting for us, and she was outside with my son, and the neighbor dog was let out without a leash, came over and bit her fairly severely. She's going to need
oh.
to see plastic surgeons and,
oh.
and whatnot. It's kind of a big thing.
Oh.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah, thank you. But she's hesitant to reach out to a personal injury lawyer. She doesn't want to go that route. I'm trying to encourage her that, you know, there's some long-term consequences that she really needs to be conscious of. And then the other end of thing is, because this did happen on my property, do I have any liability?
I don't see how you're going to have any liability unless you had some prior knowledge that this dog was out running around. But listen, it's the dog's owner who has to take care to make sure that the dog doesn't get out of an enclosed area or off a leash, especially if the dog has a problem with biting people. And
to that point, I did speak with the neighbor today, and they informed me that she would be the fourth person that this dog has bitten.
Oh, my goodness.
And I don't know why animal control hasn't taken possession of the animal at this point, but they haven't. So,
yeah.
you know, that's another issue.
Here's my thought on this, and this is just my opinion, and you're it's a good thing to ask a lawyer about this, because first of all, you know, again, I'm not for putting animals down. I love animals. I love dogs. But this dog is a menace.
Exactly.
And you know what? Your sister-in-law has injuries that are significant. But what if it were a small child? And what if it were someone, an older person who got knocked down and bitten and died?
Right.
Know,
she was holding my 18-month-old in her arms when it happened. So, I mean, she's a hero in my eyes because she protected him.
Yeah.
But she, you know, again, sustained some pretty severe injuries, and I really think it's important for her to reach out to an attorney.
So I would definitely report the dog, you know, in your community, whether that's animal control in the county or to the city. You might want to call the city and find out. Maybe your alderman or whoever is you know, that is politically connected.
Mm-hmm.
What is the process here to make a complaint? Because something should be done here. This dog, if this dog has bitten three times, what are they doing letting the dog out? I mean, that's just horrendous. Second of all, about the attorney. A lot of people don't want to go that route. They think it's you know, wrong to sue other people. And listen, if your dog, and I don't know if you feel the same way, but if I make a mistake when I'm driving, or I make a mistake and I let my dog out, and you know, if it's my fault, let my insurance pay for it, because I made a mistake, or my dog
yeah.
made a mistake. And you know, if your sister-in-law may need a couple of surgeries, it may be that she needs a surgery now and may need one down the line. And it's really important that she get whatever she's entitled to make sure she can have that surgery. And, you know, she's going to have deductibles. She's going to have lost wages. She's going to have pain and suffering. She's going to have scarring. And all of those things are compensable. And again, I'm not one to stoke litigation. I'm not one to make things up when there's nothing there. I don't even do personal injury work, so I don't make money on doing personal injury, but I
sure.
think she needs to find a lawyer to do that. And I actually, there's a colleague I work with at Fox who had a very bad dog bite, And I found her a very good lawyer, and she ended up settling with the neighbor. And so it didn't have to go to court. But I think it's important to find the right lawyer. And if you would like to email me, I will refer you to that same lawyer who got the settlement. And it was the right thing to do. It all worked out just fine without court and litigation and all of that thing. So let me, I'm going to put you on hold, Darren, and I'm going to give everybody my phone number and my email address. My email address is WGN@AskKarenConti.com, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. My number, 312-332-7800. We've got several more segments now to take your legal questions, so get them in now, and you can text as well to 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. We are here at the Karen Conti Show taking your legal questions on any topic you might have. Family law, criminal law, wills and trust, employment matters, anything that is something that you have in your mind, give a call here and I will try to answer it or steer you in the right direction. It's Karen Conti, and I've been practicing law for 33 years and I've practiced in a lot of different practice areas, and I can talk a little bit about some of your topics. I may not be able to give you a very specific answer, but I can certainly get you in the right direction. The number here is 312-981-7200, or you can text to that same number. Let's go to Tim in Chicago Heights. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Karen. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I've listened to you for years, and I need your advice. I am trying to leave a bank, and we're not in good terms, and I'm trying to uncouple myself. Here's the thing. I have some savings there, and I have a retirement account, and my Social Security comes to the bank.
Okay.
I thought it was a good fix. I thought it was a good fit, but it isn't. So I am asking you, how is there a way? I want to decouple myself from this bank. Is there a way I could go? I have another bank to go to, and they've been with me for like 33 years. How about you? 33 years practicing law. God bless you. Okay. Is there a way I can not ever have to go? Can I go to this other bank? I don't know if this is possible. Can I go to this other bank I've been with for like 33 years and say, look, these people are not worth having. It was a bad experiment. I spent too long there. I should have been long gone. Is there a way I can decouple myself from that bank never really having to go back into the bank?
Tim, I'm going to put you on hold because there's a little echo here that is very annoying. But, that's not a big deal. I mean, if you don't want to go in there, that might be a problem. But is there another branch you can go to? There are probably some procedures that you will have to go through. You'll have to sign your name and transfer funds. And if you can't do it online yourself, you could go in there and ask for whatever documentation or ask for a bank person to fill out the whatever forms are necessary to close out your accounts, to transfer the money. I'm not sure if they can transfer to another bank, or you'd have to take the cash out and then walk it over to your other bank. But I don't know what the problem is really for you. You don't want to walk in there. You don't like those people. You don't like what they've done. Maybe there's another bank branch you can go to. Why wouldn't you just try to do that and you wouldn't face the people you know there? But I probably will have to go in there and fill out some forms. And again, I don't know what those forms are. Every bank's different. If you're online, a lot of times you can transfer funds via computer. And I'm not sure if you can close accounts without having to go in there and sign things away. So the best thing to do is to perhaps, if you wanted to call the main branch and say, how do I go about closing these accounts? See if you can get a human being on the phone, which is always a challenge with banks. But then you can get an idea of what you actually need to do and what you need to sign in order to get what you want done. Hopefully that answers your question, Tim. Call me at 981-7200. I'm answering legal questions. Let's go to Darlene. Hi, Darlene. Well, welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't even know if this is legal. Anywho, I'm a proponent of following rules and regulations, and the rules in my condo is that we can have pets, but you have to use the service elevator. But I no longer live where the service elevator is. I'm on the first floor and a few feet from the front door. And now that I'm handicapped, they're giving me a hard time about taking my pet in and out. He's a little dog, a Shih Tzu. So I'm just wondering, can they allow me for years? I've been living here about 4 years on the first floor to put me through this rigmarole. I have to walk through the garage to walk him. And those white caps sometimes come off the lake into the parking lot, and they can really knock you down. So I was just wondering, do I have any rights?
Okay. Well, the American with Disabilities Act basically says that they have to accommodate your disability. And what is your, can you tell me what your disability is, Darlene? Is it something physical?
Yeah, well, now it is. I can hardly walk. I'm on a cane.
Okay.
I've had hip replacement surgery, and I'm legally blind.
Okay, all right.
But
okay.
Usually I navigate pretty good if I know the lay of the land. And the board and management has been allowing me for years, when I first bought this unit, to walk the dog through there. In fact, because I used to follow the rules because I thought I had to, I would carry him. They used to tease me. They would call my dog my purse. Well, I see you got your purse today.
Okay,
because they never saw him walk.
Okay, I think you're in your right there to say that you're disabled. You're legitimately disabled. You have medical records to prove it. And if it's something that endangers you to walk as far as the service elevator, and in, because you're legally blind, it's hard for you to navigate, they should accommodate your disability. And I would say that what you should do is write a letter to the board, a CC everybody, if you're on computer, have someone help you do it if you need to, and say, listen, this, you've been doing this for years. I can't bring the dog to the service elevator for the following reasons. Here are my disabilities. Here, you know, I have medical records to back it up if you need that. And I request an accommodation,
right,
under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then get an answer in writing and demand an answer in writing. And if they don't do that, your next step is to report them, probably to the EEOC, or you can have a lawyer write a letter. So why don't we do this? Why don't, Darlene, you try,
yeah,
to do that. Try to do what I said by writing the letter and use those words so they know that this is legal, because a lot of condo board people don't really know the law, you know, and they may not know that this is illegal, and see what their answer is. And if not, then you'll email me or you'll call me at the office, and I'll see what I can do to help you and steer you in the right direction. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
You. Thank you.
Okay. Good luck, Darlene. I hope that works
thank
for you.
You.
All right. I'm going to be taking more of your legal questions. I'm going to get to you, Terry, in just a minute, but we're going to take a break. And you're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Call us at 981-7200. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I am taking your legal questions of any type, 981-7200. Any legal question you might have, or a friend might have, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. Let's go to Terry in Newark, Illinois. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Hi, Karen.
Terry, where is Newark, Illinois?
It's by Yorkville or Oswego.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure I ever heard of that little community there.
It is a very little community.
Yeah, but now I know. Okay. What is your question?
Okay, my question is, if my parents would pass away and not sell their timeshares, would my sisters and I, as heirs to their estate, be responsible for the maintenance fees on these timeshares?
You know, timeshares, what a pain. You know, before you buy a timeshare, please, please, please consider it. I don't know if it's the beer goggles that happen when you go on vacation, but they just have created so many legal problems. Generally speaking, and I would have to read the terms and conditions, okay, to give you specific advice, but generally speaking, whoever inherits the property, the timeshare, has to then pay pay all of those fees and whatever they are, okay? So what you need to do if you inherit that and you don't want to inherit that is you have to disclaim that inheritance. And there's a formal procedure by which you do that. And then that property would go to the next of kin. So let's just say that you and your, if you got a sister and they go both to the sisters and then you disclaim and then it goes to, say, a grandchild or whoever is next, that person would also have to disclaim ownership. That's the appropriate way to do it. Now, there's some timeshares that will have provisions to buy out, provisions that when you die, certain things happen. But, you know, you should probably have someone take a really good look at that and make sure you handle it appropriately. The other thing to know is, let's just say that it did come to you, okay, and you used it, okay, and then you decided this is too expensive, it's not worth it, you can't do it at that point. Now you've used it, and now you have taken ownership of it, and you probably have a legal obligation then to keep up whatever payments there are. But again, this is something that's a very important legal issue that you could probably have someone take a look at and come to a conclusion. Now, some of these companies that you hear on WGN do this timeshare thing, and maybe that's an option that you have to explore. Have them take a look at that and try to figure out whether or not there's a way to get rid of it short of, you know, doing this whole procedure that we have here. Okay,
can you re-deed those back to the company? Or
in some cases you can, in some cases you cannot. And there's some cases where there's a buyout provision.
I know
there's a buyout provision sometimes that's very expensive that makes it difficult for someone to give it back. I'm not an expert in this area. I know that there are lawyers who do this, but I don't know how successful lawyers are who do this, because these are very difficult contracts. They're contracts that you sign and that you're bound by. And you know, it's something that before you even sign one of these, you should consult with a lawyer who's very experienced in the area of timeshares to make sure you understand what you might be doing to not only yourselves, you know, as a couple, but maybe your heirs in the future.
Right.
I'm sorry, I can't give you specific advice, Terry, because they're all a little different. But just know that by inheriting something, you might inherit with it the responsibilities that are associated with it. Okay.
Do you know any attorneys that work with timeshares?
Yeah, you know what? Why don't you email me at the office? And I do have somebody who I've referred this kind of thing to. I don't know how successful they've been, but at least they have some experience in it. So I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give out my email address, and I will give you the name of that lawyer. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Good luck. All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Terry, have a good night. My email address is wgn@AskKarenConti.com. That's KarenConti.com. It's a confidential email line. It goes right to my desk, so no one else gets it. Password protected. So I can get right back to you and hopefully give you an answer. A texter from the 847 area code said, I'm wondering if there is a statute of limitations on malpractice for a surgery gone wrong, and it looks like the surgery was in 2015. Generally speaking, the statute of limitations for negligence or malpractice, or car accidents for that matter, is 2 years. And it's 2 years from the date of the malpractice. Okay, so if the surgery was 2015 and you're now here in 2019, you probably are out of luck. However, there's an issue if you didn't realize that there was malpractice for some reason, you might have an extended statute of limitations. So let's just say that you had an operation in 2015, but you've been having complications for years. You finally went to the doctor, and they found in an x-ray that they had left in, you know, a sponge or something, and that was causing the problem. Well, because you weren't aware of the malpractice, how would you have known? And you just were made aware of it, that statute of limitations for that cause of action could be extended, and you could have a way to bring a lawsuit. What I would suggest to you, texter, is to email me the facts, email me the county where it happened, and I will hook you up with a lawyer who does this kind of work and who can maybe make that assessment with you to see if perhaps you still have the right to sue and to bring a lawsuit. And just a little bit of a warning for everybody. It's very important if you have something that goes wrong, whether it's malpractice or a car accident or an employment situation, And I'm not saying you should hurry up and sue. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, most of the advice I give during my business day is not to sue, is to resolve things and try to work things out. But if you're going to sue and you think you have a lawsuit and you don't have any options other than to make a claim, then you need to do it right away. You cannot wait. The more you wait, the more problematic it's going to be. And you just don't want to get to the point where you do have some serious medical issue or some financial issue that can only be resolved through the litigation that you cannot now bring because of the law. So make sure you get your advice as soon as you possibly can and not to delay. Tom, welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi. Yeah, hi. Hello, can you hear me?
I can. Tell me what your legal question is.
Yeah, hi. So the question I got is, in a divorce, I have custody, and there's a child advocate attorney that's still involved. It's been going on for a long time. And the judge ruled that every time somebody calls a child advocate or something happens, it's split 50-50 down the middle. She has to pay half. I have to pay half. It's been going on for years. I never call. I never do anything with the child's advocate. My ex-wife does it all, and I still have to pay for half. And I don't see how that's fair because I'm not the one creating, you know, let's say the invoice. I'm not creating these invoices, but yet I'm responsible for half.
Okay.
And I've asked, can she just be responsible when she calls, and I do the same. I'm responsible for what, you know, invoices I approve.
Okay.
And the judge said no.
All right, Tom, can I put you on hold? You can still listen to the show, right?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold just because there's a little bit of noise in the background. This is a difficult one. So you have a guardian ad litem, which is a person who's appointed by the court to kind of monitor the situation and act on behalf of the minor child. So that person is the go-between. And generally speaking, that person's fees are split 50-50, or sometimes they're split commensurate with how much each party makes. So if someone's making double the amount of money, it could be that the person's paying that person is paying a larger percentage. Generally speaking, it's not split on who calls the GAL, the guardian ad litem, just because, let's just say, Tom, and I'm not saying that this is the kind of guy you are, let's just say that you're violating the court orders, okay? And she keeps calling the guardian, and she's the one who's, you know, saying, hey, he's violating. Well, just because you didn't call doesn't mean you're not at fault. Sometimes it's fault-based. So sometimes a guardian can assess fees against one party who maybe is not honoring a court order. So for instance, you know, if for some reason she's not getting your child back to you on time, and it's constant and it's significant, and the child is not going to sleep on time, and she's violating court orders, it could be that because you call, that's not the operative issue. The issue could be, was she at fault? And if she's at fault, why should you pay for half of the issue? A lot of judges will refuse to change the payment arrangement because they want both parties to have a stake in it. They don't want either party to bring this back to court. And the way to do that is basically punish both parties by having to pay to bring these issues to the court's attention. Again, if you formally ask the court to reassess the fee arrangement and the judge has said no, you're kind of out of luck. If you can ask the guardian, can we change this so we can give her an incentive not to do this and bring me back to court, maybe the guardian herself or himself will address it with the court and say, I think that would be an effective way to prevent these parties from being back in the courthouse. But that's my best advice. Good luck to you, Tom. I still have some time to answer your legal questions. 312-981-7200. I love Stevie Wonder. Hasn't he been performing for 5 or 6 decades or something crazy like that? I was just listening to the radio and what was that first song that he did? Something Fingers. What was that called? Remember that? He was 7 years old or something. What an amazing talent. We're taking your legal questions. 981-7200. The phone lines are wide open. Ben has nothing to do. I mean, he's just sitting there just basically, you know, just getting his minimum wage job here. Just, you know, by doing nothing. No, I'm just kidding. He's happy to talk to you, and he's happy to answer the phone and get you on the air as soon as possible. We also have the text, 981-7200. I'm going to give out my phone number and my email address at the office in case you want to talk to me privately. My number there is 312 312- 833-2780 or email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. I'm looking at a text here, 773. One of my neighbors constantly harasses me, falsely accuses me of taking his property, even threatens to plant drugs on me. What actions can I take? You know, I get these questions probably every week. It's amazing how many people are unhinged, I think, and like to wreak havoc on their neighbors and find it almost like a full-time job where they find different ways to harass and bully and do all kinds of things and annoy. And it really, you might laugh at it and say it's funny and it's horrible. But it's comical. It actually isn't, because your home is the place where you're supposed to go and be stress-free. It's a place you're supposed to go and feel safe. And some of these neighborhood disputes will escalate, and they escalate into violence. And you've seen it if you watch any of the crime shows, you've seen the neighbors who pull out the shotguns, and it reaches such a level that that people have to move or they don't want to live there anymore. So the best thing to do, in my view, again, this is like what your mom tells you, if someone's bothering you, is just to ignore it and ignore it as best you can and not to engage, because people that do this, their personalities are such, and I've learned this over the years, they want you to engage. They want to know that they're affecting you. And when you engage with them, it escalates, and then they will do it more and they will find new ways to irritate and annoy you. In this case, I don't know all of the facts. He falsely accuses me of taking his property. I don't know if that means there's a false police report. He threatens to plant drugs on me. You know, one of the things that I tell people to do, if he's unhinged, you're not going to change him. Okay, you're not going to really change his behavior, but he may respond if someone else brings this to his attention. So in many communities, you can call the police, non-emergency number, and see if there's somebody there who can help with a neighborhood dispute. Because depending on where you live, and sometimes in Chicago, the Chicago police are too busy solving murders and all kinds of other horrible things that are going on. But in some of the suburban communities, there are people who will actually help you try to resolve it and will actually go to your neighbor and maybe try to talk about, don't do this, don't escalate it, we're going to watch you, that we think this is wrong, and kind of give the talk to make sure that he knows the ramifications of what he's doing. Accusing you, threatening to plant drugs on you, nothing so far actionable, but if he does any of those things, then of course you can take action and you can report him to the police. But it may be that just reporting him to the police and having a talk with the police department about what strategies, because it could be that he's doing this to other neighbors. My guess is that when someone is harassing somebody, they're not just they're an equal opportunity harasser, and they may be doing it to other neighbors. So there may be a talk that that the police officers can have with him. And again, de-escalate. Absolutely. I have another texter at 708. I own a small restaurant and pay my employees with paper checks. A former employee electronically deposited his payroll through his mobile banking app. Then he proceeded to cash the same check via a currency exchange. Interesting. I always wondered how the bank would know, or the currency exchange would know, that you hadn't already done that. That's my little editorial comment. My bank returned the check to the currency exchange, stating the check already had been presented. Now the currency exchange is suing me to collect plus attorney's fees. Thoughts, please. Well, I don't know the answer to your question, and I've never seen this question before. I wondered why it didn't happen. But I don't understand how you would be responsible for paying that check, because your bank is the entity that paid it. And if the bank already paid it via the banking app on the phone, then why did the bank pay it again when he cashed it? That seems to me to be the bank's fault and not yours. Again, if you're being sued, I don't know how much is involved. You're going to have to defend it, and perhaps you have to bring in the bank and say, to the extent that I'm responsible for this, the bank is actually responsible for it. You might want to send me a quick email at my office and tell me how much is involved and where the court case is proceeding, because I would hate for you to have to hire a lawyer over a small amount of money, and it may be that you just pay it so you don't get, have a problem with this. But if you want to insist on fighting it, I would say start with the bank and tell them that they need to make this make this right. I assume your employee is no longer your employee, and you would have a right to absolutely sue him if that were the case. Another texter from last week, I wanted to address this. Jane texted me and said that she had worked for a company for 5 years. She gave her 2 weeks' notice, as she thought she should, and the company told her that she had to leave immediately that day. And they fired her immediately. And she said, can they do this? I gave my 2 weeks' notice. I was prepared to work for 2 weeks. How can they fire me? And number two, because they fired me, now can I file for unemployment? And that's a very good question. So if you give your 2 weeks' notice, which is the proper thing to do from, you know, an employment standpoint, I always say take the high road. You don't want to leave your employer high and dry. Your employer can fire you for that and, you know, say, no, I'm sorry, you're going to, you know, I'm not going to let you quit. I'm going to fire you, because a lot of employers don't want someone in the office who might be disgruntled or taking trade secrets or taking documents of some type. So it's their right to do that. And so that's perfectly fine. You have no lawsuit. However, because they fired you, they preemptively fired you, now you have a right to claim unemployment. Had you just quit, you would not have been entitled to unemployment, because you don't get unemployment for quitting a job. Interestingly, now you have a right to get unemployment.